John Simpson, amazing to have you on the 20 Questions With podcast. I mean, you really need no introduction, but I'll give you a very, very brief one. And that is to say that you are the BBC's World Affairs editor, and you have been there and done that and got the T-shirt. In fact, you've got a lot of T-shirts, no doubt. We've only got 20 questions. My first is just to ask you what it's like being John Simpson.
Well, it's like for everybody. You just think it's both normal and weird and embarrassing and absurd and funny. And what I think so much, actually, Matthew, is that I sit at a meeting table with all sorts of really highly qualified people and. Somebody says, "What do you think, John?" And I give my two penneth, which could be really stupid. It could, and everybody listens as though, it's the voice of God. I mean, 20, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, they'd have said, "Yeah, do you have anything to say, John?" And I'd have said, probably much better, more sensible things. And they'd say, Yeah. Okay, now we go to Sir Robin, and it's the same old person, the same old ideas. Nothing much has changed.
I remember when I worked for the BBC and I was there for sort of 8.5 years or so, I sometimes found myself wishing there was someone who could champion the corporation, who could get out there and make the case for it. And you on Twitter seem sometimes to be performing that role or filling that role. You've got well over 200,000 followers. You've sort of embraced that technology. I wonder whether you're aware of that, whether that's part of your intention.
Well, I'll tell you what, I believe wholeheartedly, 100% in the notion of public service broadcasting and the way it's done, particularly in this country. And I believe, rightly or wrongly, it's the best broadcasting system there is. And so it irritates me when the kind of midget wrestlers get on the on Twitter and nibble away at it. But I've realized you might think this was pretty obvious, but it's taken me some time to realize you've got to choose your moment, you've got to choose your issue, and you've got to be pretty confident that what you say in defense of an outfit like the BBC is gonna hold up. Because if it doesn't, you're gonna look an idiot, and the BBC's going to suffer for it. I know that my employers, my bosses are uneasy. I mean, I think sometimes they're very glad and grateful when I defend the BBC or make statements about the BBC's principles and so on. I know that. But at other times, I do get the feeling that they are nervous and that they'd rather. I kind of, not that I'd shut up exactly, but that perhaps I'd be a little less sort of confrontational in the BBC's defense. And it's probably, I mean, it's just my character. If there's a Barney, I like to get involved. It's just how these things are. But I mean, I know you didn't agree with me when I tried to explain why the BBC wouldn't call Hamas a terrorist organization, because we try and avoid characterizing these things. Of course, one of the things that came up after that was that dozens of people checked out. And of course, broadcasters of the BBC, even I, use words like terrorism in the past, not for an organization in my case, like Hamas, but I've said, two terrorists in Nigeria, I think I was writing about. So of course we all, let the principle slip a bit. But I just feel there ought to be somebody that's out there from the organization defending it, exactly as you said at the start of your question. And, sometimes I get a bloody nose, sometimes I don't. But at least somebody's doing it.
You've spent your career at the BBC. Incredibly, you're going to be 80 later this year. How do you see the role of the BBC in this country evolving? And will it be here? in 10, 20 years' time in the same sort of way in which it's here at the moment?
I don't know. I don't know. I think we're passing from a phase where we've had, 14 years of a government whose prime ministers and ministers knew that there were brownie points in it for them to attack the BBC. I assume now, although, you know, who can say, but I assume now we're going to some years, at any rate, of a Labour government, which also is no friend of the BBC, but it does get the principle more precisely than Conservative governments tend to do. There's not so much in it for Labour ministers to kick the BBC for its perceived biases, that kind of thing. Not because, as I say, not because they love the BBC. And, you know, the greatest damage in my lifetime to the BBC was done by a Labour government, by Tony Blair and Alistair Campbell, after we said, well, quite accurately, as it turned out, you know, that there was no real evidence for the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But, I mean, so, you know, we can't know really whether the BBC as it exists will continue. But I get the feeling that as we get into this new, quite disturbing age of artificial intelligence and so forth, it might well be much, much better for people to know that there's one or two or three, I would say four stations in Britain that they can turn to, one of them being the BBC, that they know won't be broadcasting fake news. So we may be entering a new phase of where the BBC has real value, partly because of its past.
The BBC, of course, is populated by human beings. Do you think it is biased by mistake? I mean, given that we as human beings are far from perfect, even if we intend something, it doesn't always work out like that.
No, that's absolutely true. What I would say is that it is populated by people who believe in the basic principle and don't just mouth off their own ideas just simply because they like the sound of their own voice. And that, you know, everything I say sounds as though I'm saying the BBC is absolutely wonderful. All the rest of the broadcasters are rubbish. That's not my line at all. But I am just defending here the BBC's tone. I mean, is it full of Guardian readers? Probably not. I think it's, I don't know, it looks to me as though it's more full of Times and Daily Mail readers, actually. But, you know, what people think and say privately is not the same necessarily that they would say in public. And, I mean, when I think of the range of people that I work with, they've got their own views. They make jokes all the time about whoever happens to be in government. I mean, that's a given. But they know what the limitations are. They know what they ought to say in public, and they know what they ought not to say in public. And I mean, I've got quite a lot of faith in the ability of the people that I work for to follow the BBC's principles, even if they don't come instinctively to them. That is the way they work.
Do you feel as strongly about the survival or the importance of the survival of, say, BBC Entertainment as you might about the survival, the endurance of BBC News? When we're talking about the BBC, its future, and the role of public service broadcasting?
Well, it's very, I mean, this is an argument that goes right back to the very founding of the BBC 2 years ago. Should you be terribly serious and valuable in some sort of social sense, or should you simply do everything, broadcast about everything to people? And that argument was won early on in the BBC's time, and they started to have, you know, comedians on and dance bands and everything. And course, people, you know, sat down with their quill pens and said, you know, I am disgusted that my license fee should go on the playing of dance music, you know, evil dance music, which is corrupting the morals of the country. I mean, you know, things don't change very much. I think it's got to be all things to all people. Otherwise, why should it exist, really? Why should, what's its value if it doesn't get everybody who has to pay for it?
Not everyone, even of my age, I'm 44, will know that in the very, very early 1980s, you were actually briefly the BBC's political editor. So your focus was on domestic politics. And I wonder how you compare that experience to reporting the world.
Well, it was very different. It was one of the reasons why I didn't enjoy it, to be honest, Matthew. It was, I felt then that you needed to have a different set of career skills than the ones that I actually had. I was young in the job. I think I was about 34, 35. I'd had, my whole background was in foreign news. And, you know, when you're reporting foreign news, you can be much more, I'm trying to think of the right adjective. I mean, you can be much more open about it. You don't need to scratch your head and worry about, you know, are you damaging the BBC's interests, for instance. But when I was the political editor, Margaret Thatcher was in her earliest years in power. She got in 1979, and I started a few months afterwards. And, you know, she was the first prime minister we'd ever had in Britain who had a, you know, she really wanted to do something about the BBC. She didn't like it, and she didn't see why it should exist, and she was looking for ways to hit it. And I felt, I don't think I've ever said this before, I felt that it wasn't the job that I wanted to do. It was to report on Margaret Thatcher, as well as, of course, the opposition to her, meant that you had all the time to think, to have in the back of your mind, I've got to be careful here. I can't just say what I think I ought to say about these things. There are other concerns that come in, one of which was the future of the BBC itself. And I just was uneasy about that. That's not what I want to be as a journalist. I don't want to be cautious. I don't want to tiptoe around realities and not say what I believe to be the truth about them. So when the war broke out with Argentina, I did some reporting on that. I had tremendous troubles with Downing Street about the kind of things I was reporting. And in the end, another job came up, presenting the Our Main News, was then at 9 o'clock. And I just thought, yeah, I don't think I want to carry on this, you know, this very careful tiptoeing kind of reporting. I just want to get out and do what I like to do, which is, you know, go and find things out and tell people about them. And so I read the 9 o'clock news, and then that came to an end. I don't think I was a great success in that. And I went back to what I loved doing, which was reporting on the world.
Before we talk about the world, is it true or is it apocryphal that Prime Minister Wilson, Harold Wilson, punched you in the stomach?
Oh, no, entirely true. Entirely, entirely true. It was my first day as a reporter for the BBC. So that was 1970. Must be April the 2nd, I think, 1970. And in those days, it's actually, that's rather come back, I'm afraid. People used to talk about Downing Street sources, or my sources say, and the sources then were saying that Wilson was going to call an election So my boss, who was as new to the job as I was, said to me, Harold Wilson's doing a photo op this morning at Euston Station on his way to Liverpool. Go down there, ask him if there's going to be an election. So in those days, even the possibility of a British election was major international news. So all the American networks were there on platform 7 Euston Station. I could take you down exactly to the very point where all this happened, very spot. All the Europeans were there, and of course, all the Brits and everything. A huge crowd. And characteristically, I was late. So there wasn't, and I was working for radio. So I was on my own with my microphone, nowhere. I couldn't see any place to stand, so I had to stand in front of people. It was people with, you know, cameramen saying, move out of the way, Sonny, can't see through you, and all that kind of stuff. And Wilson turned up, and I looked around. Everybody was smiling. Well, it was a photo op. I was so innocent, I didn't realise what that was. So nobody was obviously going to ask him anything. So I thought, well, it's up to me. So I walked, stepped forward with my microphone at the sort of fixed bayonet position and said, excuse me, Prime Minister, but, you know, newspapers are full of talk about an election. Are you going to call an election? Except I didn't get that far. I got as far as, excuse me, Prime, when he exploded and he punched me in the stomach with his right hand. And with his left hand, he tried to break the microphone out of my hand. And he said, this is outrageous. You know I never do these things. Your director general knows this. Directly I get to Liverpool, I'm going to put in the strongest complaint about your appalling behaviour. And then he swept past. All these detectives, officials, and they all gone on the train. And I looked at my watch and it was, I think, 10 to 11 on the morning of my first outing as a reporter, and I'd been physically assaulted by the Prime Minister and was going to lose my job, except that actually Wilson, I got to know him quite well afterwards, and he was quite a warm character. And I think, you know, who breaks a butterfly upon a wheel? I mean, you know, it wasn't important enough for the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom to destroy somebody. So he didn't make the call, and I didn't lose my job. But it was a sort of, I mean, worse things happened to me afterwards, but it was quite a good start.
Okay, just two very quick sub questions to follow up. One, did it hurt? And two, did the exchange make it to air?
Question one, yes, it hurt quite a lot, because although he wasn't much sort of physically, he did seem to be able to pack quite a punch, especially when it gets you under the, you know, the diaphragm. Secondly, yeah, the world's press were there, as I say. Must have been 40 cameras, something like that. They all got it. Not a single one published it or broadcast it or anything. Because in those days, as one of the cameramen said to me, as we were all sort of breaking up, you don't just ask the Prime Minister a question like that, Sonny. And I thought, I thought you did. I thought that was what being a journalist was about, but not in 1970.
You said earlier that things don't change much. Well, that's certainly changed, because that would be leading all the bulletins for days. Oh,
and I don't know that a prime minister who physically attacked somebody, as Wilson did, could survive. I suspect not on something like that. Not on something which was a perfectly reasonable, well, if I'd been allowed to ask it, would have been a perfectly reasonable question to ask. Are we going to have a general election? I mean, you might think that was of interest to every single person in the country. No, well, that has changed. That's certainly changed, and for the better. But what hasn't changed is that, well, what did change for a while was that, you know, when a Downing Street official told you something, you said a Downing Street official, sometimes you could be more precise than that, tells me that such and such. And we've sunk back in the last 20 years to just giving these hints. You know, I've got these wonderful contacts and I'm telling you what they're telling me. I don't like that. I like to know where my information's coming from.
Some might say that Trump could get away with physically assaulting someone and it not affect his chances of becoming president, might even increase them. He is an extraordinary politician, whether one agrees with him or disagrees with him, likes him or dislikes him. And I just wonder whether you have a view on how to report a figure like Trump. I mean, you are the BBC's World Affairs editor. He's said some truly appalling things and done some appalling things. And I wonder how the BBC can best approach that in your view. Because he was democratically elected. I mean, he was the president of the USA, the most powerful man in the world. He may well be president again.
I feel you can't just treat him as any other normal political figure. I feel you've got to encompass the whole person and personality of the man, and that includes of the all the kind of things that he says and are the most offensive things, as you well know. And I feel you have to broaden the categories of your reporting on somebody like that, because it is the man himself. So, for instance, I mean, this is a just one example. When I report about him for my program on a couple of occasions, I've talked about how, he presents himself as the great deal maker, as the man that can solve the world's problems with the power of the United States. And I've just reminded people on two particular occasions, and I'm sure on many others, he's demonstrated the deal making, supposed deal making capacity that he has in a pretty kind of weak way. So that, for instance, with the Taliban in Afghanistan in his last years, he was desperate in his last year or something, he was desperate for what would look like a foreign policy success. And so he went. He sent his people to talk to the Taliban in the Gulf, and he said, we will pull out our troops in exchange for a promise from you to look after women's rights better and to not be too kind of ultra religious. And so the Taliban didn't. They don't care what they sign up to. So they said, yeah, sure, yeah, fine. Women, yeah, okay, no problem. Extreme Islamism, yeah, no problem. Nobody will mind. And then, of course, they didn't keep their promise. And he had undertaken by that stage to withdraw US and therefore NATO and other troops out of Afghanistan. And appallingly, I felt personally, Joe Biden went through with the deal. One of the worst moments, really, in recent times for me. And another example of that was when he went to see Kim Jong-un in North Korea, shouting insults at him at the start, little rocket man, all that, this kind of stuff. And then saying he'd fallen in love with him, that's weird. And allowing Kim Jong-un, a midget by comparison with the president of the United States, to run rings around him and get away with everything he wanted. And so I feel that when you're talking, reporting about his amazing deal-making capacity, you have to show that actually, in effect, it isn't quite so good, and I think that's one majorly important thing, and something which I haven't personally actually gone into. But his relationship, if he has one, with Putin, why hasn't he condemned Putin for the death of Alexei Navalny, for instance? Why hasn't he criticized him more? These are the kind of things. It's not like Joe Biden. With Joe Biden, more or less what you see is more or less what you get. Not terribly impressive, actually, I would say. But with Trump, you know, there's baggage. And you mustn't, I think, allow people to forget the baggage.
You mentioned the Taliban, and I wonder whether very briefly you might take us back to 2001, when you were right at the forefront of the march, as it were, on Kabul. What was that like?
Oh, well, it was the best. I mean, it's the best story I've ever done. I mean, the entire world's press were there. And thanks, not nothing to do with me, thanks to the contacts and qualities of my cameraman, Peter Juvenal, we got right up to the front line, beyond the front line, actually. And the man who led the attack on Kabul was our landlord. We were paying him rent for a vast, great building, which we only took five rooms off of. And he just said, look, we're going at 4 o'clock tomorrow morning. So we piled in. And as I say, you know, the entire world's press were about 25 miles behind us. And only found about a lot of them only found out about it when my report came up on the radio news from, you know, the center of Kabul. So yeah, fantastically exciting. And of course, I made a joke. You should never, never, never make jokes. How stupid of me! But somebody said, you know, if the Northern Alliance haven't entered Kabul and the Americans, the British, and everything aren't there, who actually took over Kabul? And I liberated it. And I'm afraid I said, well, I suppose it was the BBC, ha ha. But the ha ha got edited out. Anyway, what do I care? But the fact was there. We were hours and hours and hours in Kabul before the first of the other world's journalists were there. And, you know, it was quite a moment.
You were in Baghdad during the first Gulf War, and I think kicked out by Saddam Hussein's authorities. You were then in Iraq again in the second Gulf War in 2003. And there you had a very, very close brush with death. And a close colleague of yours did tragically die. And you got some shrapnel in you. And I don't know whether it is still inside you, but I think it is in your backside, is it not?
It is. Every now and then, you know, I shift in my seat because it's actually quite painful even now. But they don't take shrapnel out nowadays. They prefer to let it sort of stay there because they'll do more damage cutting it out than leaving it there. Yeah, well, it was the day when the sort of phony war ended and the boots on the ground started moving into Iraq, April of 2003. And we were driving along in two vehicles, and there was a plane flying overhead. We stopped where a bunch of American special forces and Kurdish special forces had stopped, and were looking at down into a valley at a bunch of Saddam Hussein's tanks, which were firing at us, but very irregularly and carelessly. And so we there wasn't a big danger. And the American senior officer on the ground, the special forces one, radioed the pilot that was flying around overhead, just very low, about 500 feet, and said, you know, bomb the Iraqi tanks. And whether he gave the wrong coordinates, or I mean the coordinates in the wrong order, or whether the pilot took it down in the wrong order, I don't know. We know we ever, you know, there aren't, so the Americans don't hold investigations into these things, really. I don't know which it was, but anyway, whatever it was, the pilot dropped a 1,000-pound bomb on the position that the guy was reporting from. So I think 18 people died. one of whom, as you say, was my lovely translator, whom I'd hired. I mean, his photographs over there. I don't let myself forget him. And he lost both his legs, and he died of shock and loss of blood in our arms. And most of the people that died of being burned alive, because the cars were all full of explosives and things, and they started cooking off. And I got hit with a big lump of shrapnel. I've got no hearing whatever in my left ear. But since the 1,000-pound bomb fell only 13 paces away from me, we measured it out afterwards. You know, I've got a lot to be very, very grateful for. It was a loud bang. It was pretty awful, actually. One of the people in our group, a photographer, just sort of tagged along with us, went missing in all the, you know, explosions that were going on and the smoke and everything. And I felt I had to account for every one of my people. And so I had to go around all these dead bodies, turning them over, examining the faces, seeing if it was this chap. Actually, it wasn't. He'd managed to get away. But, you know, it was a rough old day's work.
You were not embedded at that point, were you?
I don't like being embedded, Matthew. I just don't think, you know, when you're dependent on a group of men, of soldiers, for your safety, your transport, your food, often your communications, you're too close to them. Their success will be your success, and vice versa. So I don't like getting into those positions where I'm kind of you know, attached to people whom I ought to be reporting on objectively. I mean, one, for instance, I got involved with a group of US Marines who went into the town of Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's headquarters, or his old sort of stamping ground. And we just followed them in, and we walked around filming them. And, you know, the way they behaved was not good. They were terrified. And anybody, any civilian that came out, for instance, on the rooftops to see what was happening, was in danger from them, including an old man who was pinning up a blanket, which he'd been washing, I suppose, or his wife had been washing it, on a rooftop. And the US Marine that I was standing next to and that we'd been filming quick whipped up his rifle, put it to his shoulder, and shouted out, "Sniper, sniper!" And I had a stick still from my experience with the 1,000-pound bomb, and I whacked him on the head with it because I thought, you know, I could see it was an old man pinning up a blanket. It was not a sniper. And he was going to kill this sniper who was actually an old man pinning up a blanket. And there was such a fuss when I whacked him that, he stopped. And the old man realized it probably wasn't very healthy to be out there on the rooftop. And but, you know, I don't want to feel that this man who's could shoot an ancient guy on a rooftop is my deliverer, my helper, my assistant. So I just prefer to be out in the open. And of course, it's not always a very healthy place to be.
You'll probably tell me that you're not brave, but you strike me, and I'm sure you'll strike everyone listening, as incredibly brave.
No.
Can you accept that on some level and try to explain where it comes from in you?
Well, No, I mean, I know how chicken I am and how nervous I am and how even little things make me nervous. So, I mean, we can dismiss the bravery. But what I do feel is if your organization has paid thousands upon thousands of pounds to get you into a place so you can report on it, you should just stick with it. You shouldn't You shouldn't walk off the story. It's your job. It's your duty. Is it permissible in modern Britain to talk about duty to do what you've been sent to do? And sometimes you get these messages from the head of something or the director general or something saying, "This is fantastic work, but your safety comes first. You mustn't ever put yourself in a position of danger." And you just think, well, that's very nice of them, but you shouldn't be here at all. If you don't want to do the job, don't go and then at the last moment say, "Oh, I'm walking out." You've got to see it through. And so often, you get these messages. I've had three in particular that I can remember from the top person saying, "Your safety comes first. Do not put your." And on each of the occasions I got these things from, it hadn't been my work at all. Or else, I was putting a voice over a cameraman's pictures, and the cameraman took the risk, but I didn't. And another occasion when it really, I must have looked quite dangerous, I suppose, but it actually wasn't in the slightest bit. Now, you don't want to shout these things from the rooftops because that sort of undermines people's confidence in what you're saying. But at the same time, I just think, well, in my case, certainly, I should think all the stuff about incredible courage and everything. I just take it with a pinch of salt,
What is it then that has driven you to tell these stories around the world?
Well, I get these ideas and I want to see what's really, really going on. I mean, the most dangerous thing I think I've ever done was going to the Amazonian forest in Peru and doing stuff about how the Peruvian army was killing just ordinary, just the villagers in these places, how they'd just carry out broad massacres right through the place. And that was probably much more dangerous, even than being blown up in northern Iraq. But I just think again, you if you're there, if you set out to see these things and to tell people what's going on, you've got to stick with it. You have a feeling that you just want to tell people, Matthew. And if you say, if you come to the end of the story and they say, yes, what happened? You say, well, after that, I decided I'd probably be safer off coming home. I mean, that you don't want to do that. You don't want to do that. You want to be able to say, as I can say in this case, the colonel who was in charge of these operations was jailed for life as a result of our reporting. Full stop. Now let's get on to the next question. That's what I think good journalism is.
Can a little knowledge be a dangerous thing as a reporter? So you go to report on a conflict or you go to report on a story in a foreign country, and you're just one person there, well, with your crew. Is there a danger that things can be oversimplified or even got wrong?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think this business of kind of you find it more in American journalism than you do in British journalism, but kind of identifying the good guys and then making clear to everybody who the good guys are, that I really dislike very much. I mean, for instance, in the one of the worst stories that I've had to cover was the siege of Sarajevo, which went on for three years, and a lot of people, and particularly in the American press, identified the good guys as being the Muslim government, which was based in Sarajevo, the Bosnian government, and the bad guys as the Bosnian Serbs and the Bosnian Croats. And yeah, I mean, they had a point, certainly, but to give the impression that the the Muslims were utterly innocent was a great mistake, I think. And you know, that I don't feel you should cover up something because it's kind of inconvenient. But it, you know, my time there reporting was actually quite hard because I didn't really like that approach too much. I didn't like seeing the Sarajevo government as a sort of innocent, entirely innocent victims, even though they were the victims and they weren't as guilty as the other two. But the ludicrousness of this was shown to me by a friend of mine on one of the US networks, who said, showed me a letter, a message he'd had from his editor, his foreign editor. He said, look, I understand that in Sarajevo there are three sides, that there's the Muslims, the Croats and the Serbs. But he said American viewers can't cope with three sides to a war. So in future, I don't want to hear any reference whatever to the Bosnian Croats. Just leave them out of the whole thing. What do you say to something like that? How can you just kind of whitewash out one of the major forces fighting? Actually, some of the people who did some of the worst atrocities were the Croats. So absurdity is never very far away from journalism, as you know, and that was one of the more absurd moments.
You've described some traumatic events, John, both witnessing terrible things happening to others and to yourself. Have you felt traumatized by some of the work that you've done? And if so, have you attempted to address it?
Well, yeah, I have. You couldn't go through the kind of stuff. I worked it out once that I've kind of had near death experiences 10 times. And that's not, you know, a bullet hitting the wall on the far side of the room. This is a bullet hitting the wall immediately behind you, or a bomb or something like that. I've found, well, I'll tell you an example. I was in Afghanistan and we were there to film an execution, a triple execution. Awful guys who had done terrible things, but, you know, I'm not in favor of executing anybody for anything. And it was, they made a mess of it. And I thought, as I was watching all this, I thought, this is going to be in my dreams forever. For as long as I live, I'm going to wake up, I'm going to see these faces, I'm going to see what's happening to the chaps. And indeed, that night, I had really, really bad dreams. But the next day, in those days, we were encouraged to write for the press, and I had a weekly column for the Sunday Telegraph, and I wrote all about this in detail, and I thought about it an awful lot. And I, in those days, again, you used to dictate the piece to a copy taker at the other end. And at the end, the woman, very kind of motherly woman, said, oh, you poor dear, I'm so sorry you had to go through all that. And that kind of somehow took the poison out of it. I mean, I think about it, but I don't dream about it. I don't wake up in the middle of the night thinking about it. And the same has happened. I think it's something to do with the business of writing and broadcasting and talking about it. And after our experience being blown up by the US Air Force, the producer and I, everybody else, all the rest of my team decided that they'd had enough, understandably, and wanted to go home. But the producer and I felt we had to finish the job. And so we went down to Baghdad from there, and it must have taken 4 days, I suppose. And we just talked about everything all the time, all the awful stuff, all the things we'd seen. And as we drove into Baghdad itself, said, you know, welcome to Baghdad, the sign over the road. I think it was I started off another round of all this stuff. And the producer said, do you know what? I'm really sick of talking about it. And I thought, yeah, I am too. And I think that's, you know, I didn't go and sit in a shrink's office, but I think that Tom Giles was my shrink, the producer, and I think I was his. I certainly don't have bad dreams. I probably should, but I don't, which is a shame, really, because if I could prove to the BBC that I had PTSD, they would, I think, be obliged to employ me till I was 99 and two thirds. Whereas I think probably my time with the BBC is starting to draw near.
Well, you've hurried along a question I was going to ask you. We've got five left. Do you ever think you might retire, or will you keep going and going? And why not?
My dear friend, Charles Wheeler, more than a friend, he was a sort of, you know, he was my role model and my advisor and everything. And he contracted very, very, very sadly. He contracted throat cancer and or lung cancer, I'm not sure which, something that affected his speech. But he carried on broadcasting right up to, I think, about 2 months before he died at the age of 88. That's what I'd like to do. I'm sure I won't be the world affairs editor of the BBC, but they might find some corner for me to carry on scribbling in.
Did you imagine when you were flying from Paris to Tehran with the Ayatollah Khomeini, the hell that would be unleashed on the Iranian people?
Never. No. I didn't. Well, I mean, you could see that there was going to be a big, there was going to be a really serious uprising, revolution. But that was no secret because the flight happened in at the end of January 79, and the revolution had started in January 78, and I'd seen most of the key moments of it for myself. But no, I mean, the key thing I would never have believed was that it would still be going 45 years later. Such a sophisticated country. I mean, people think it's all full of black-robed people, men with long beards chanting death to America, death to Britain, all this kind of stuff. Actually, the great majority of Iranians are very kind of moderate and gentle. And the cities, the main cities, particularly Tehran, they're very westernized cities, at least as westernized as the big cities in Turkey, and probably actually perhaps even a little bit more. And to restrict the lives of people in a western-oriented country like that, in the way that the Iranian revolutionaries have, for 45 years, that's an extraordinary thing. What's going to happen? The trouble is you can't tell because there's no leader of the opposition that everybody accepts. But I imagine at some stage the Islamic Republic would just simply collapse because it doesn't have popular support.
Do you know how many countries you have reported in, John, or at least roughly? And has there been a country, or have there been countries that you have, through your work, developed a particular affinity with?
Yeah, I have worked it out. It's a bit like, you know, kind of being a train spotter, though. So I feel slightly guilty when I list all the countries. And what is reporting? I mean, I've been to places that, you know, landed, looked around for 2 hours and jumped back in a plane and left. It's, you know, so there are varieties. It is something like 160 that I've actually reported on, not just sort of visited. Well, I mean, I find one of the sentences that I have to chop out of a lot of the stuff I write is, you know, this is a country I feel a particular love for or something, because there are a lot of them. I mean, you can't go to Iran. I must have been to Iran 20, 30 times. You can't go there without absolutely falling in love with it. It's the most beautiful, beautiful country, complicated, difficult people. I love Argentina. I'd live in Argentina if I thought I wasn't probably going to suffer, you know, drought and famine because the system collapsed around me. Wonderful, wonderful country, wonderful people. I mean, there's so many Colombia where they speak the most perfect Spanish, and it's exciting and glorious. Mexico, I mean, you can't, I could so easily live in Mexico. Hong Kong, I used to actually have plans, serious plans for spending the rest of my life in. Couldn't do that now. I'd probably be arrested. There's loads and loads and loads of country, and then there's the kind of places that you instinctively like when you speak to the people, and Canada, Australia, New Zealand. I mean, South Africa, where my wife comes from, I'd live there like a shot, except for the awful crime, which does is a problem if you're retired and old. There's so many countries. I even love Nigeria, which most people I think would say they couldn't bring themselves to do. I think Nigeria is a wonderful country. I wouldn't want to live there, but I adore traveling there. It's so difficult and complicated and awkward. Russia, I'm not sure whether I'll ever be allowed back into Russia. I love it. China, sadly, I think that's probably out for the foreseeable future. But again, a country I would adore to live in, certainly for 6 months or a year.
Before I finish by asking you about your passions and your interests outside of work, just give us a little bit of a sense of how you became who, or at least what you are, John. You went to St. Paul's School, same school I happened to go to years later. My grandfather on my mother's side might even have been your high master, although he might have come after, I'm not sure, Tom Howarth.
Yeah,
And
no, he was there when I was there. I didn't know you were late. He was wonderful to me.
yeah,
Wonderful.
he's the father of my mother. And then on my father's side, my great uncle Eric, who was a Jewish refugee, he coached you, I think, at City in broadcast journalism. How do you see your development as a person? How did you come to be the BBC man?
I think the BBC part of it was that's sort of the hit and miss. And in fact, years later, 10 years after I'd come to the BBC, I discovered that they'd given me a job because my director of studies at Cambridge had said I was certain to get a very distinguished first in English. And I got a really crap 2-2. And I said to the guy who'd been the head of the appointments board, I got a he we were having a conversation and having a drink, and he said, "Oh, you Cambridge double first." So this was 10 years after I joined. So I said, "No, come on, I got a rubbish 2-2." And he said, "No, you got a first." And I could see it mattered to him. And so I said, "Look, if I'd got a first at Cambridge, I said there wouldn't be a conversation I had with anybody that I wouldn't stick in a reference to it." And it turned out that they'd bought a pig in a poke. They hadn't. They thought they were getting some distinguished intellectual. Instead, they got me. Well, anyway, 50, 60 years later, it's a bit late to do anything about that, I suppose. So I was a BBC person almost by mistake, but actually, I think I was kind of born to be a BBC journalist. I was born to travel and go around the place, and I couldn't bear to be told what kind of line I should follow. Who are the good guys here? Who are the bad guys? I could only work for an organization, and there are plenty of others apart from the BBC, which says, go to this place and tell us what's happening and tell us honestly what's happening. And that's what I feel. I did a little bit of journalism at St. Paul's School. I did a lot of journalism at Cambridge, which is why I didn't get a good degree, because we were working too hard on other stuff. And I just think that idea of balance and common sense is something which I feel very committed to. And I think I perhaps always was.
So finally, tell us your passions, the things that really make you tick outside of work, outside of family.
Oh, terribly boring things. Music, classical music, books. I mean, how boring is that? You know, I sit, my idea of a good evening is to sit by a fire after a good dinner and go through a catalogue of books that I know I'll never be able to afford, but would love to have. 18th century books. Gosh, I can see I'm digging myself into an even smaller, deeper hole as I say this. But, you know, Henry Fielding and Lawrence Stern and the big novelists of the 18th century and the 19th century. Those are the kind of things that I love. And you know, my dog, my wife, my family, my extended family, my grandchildren, all of these things, these are the important things. And you know, when you're sitting there, perhaps listening to music with the fire on, and your, you know, the books are on the shelves. Afghanistan, Iran, Gaza, they all seem a very, very long way away. And that's how I kind of protect myself against the bad things that have gone on.
But I can imagine they're also somehow still a part of you.
Yeah, they are. They are, of course. I mean, I've got scars to prove it. You know, the knee ligament that I snapped in the bombing of Belgrade in 1999, had to have an operation in a hospital which had been bombed the night before by the American Air Force by mistake. You can imagine how nicely they treated somebody from a NATO country who'd suffered a sort of from a kind of own goal like that. Yeah, I've got the scars. I've got the, but I've also had a marvelous, happy, happy life. And you know, it's not all Sturm und Drang. It's got its peaceful, gentle, happy side. And you know, as I take the dog for a walk, I live in Oxford, and I listen to you know, maybe an Anthony Trollope novel on my headphones, and the dog looks up and looks up at me, and I look out down at the dog, and I see the birds and the canal that I walk alongside, and the flowers, and you know, I mean, those are the moments when I think I'm so grateful for, well, apart from anything else, of course, I'm grateful to be alive to do it, and I suppose that's the most important thing.
John Simpson, thank you so much for answering my 20 questions.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry I rambled on so long, half an hour longer than you. But I can't stop. You know, when you're an old boy, you don't stop somehow. You keep on long after everybody else has nodded off to sleep.